to both Livingston and St. Andrews this morning. Great to see you here. I'd like to talk about a number of these lessons, Colossians, and some about this interesting little gospel section of Martha and Mary, and then we'll talk about the psalm a little bit. So, starting with Colossians, what I would like for us to hear in this lesson is the way Jesus is spoken of as the Christ, and the kind of energy that Paul speaks about as being of the Christ, which is God's creative energy. And this is a depiction of what might be called sort of the cosmic Christ. It bears quite a bit in common with John's prologue, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Paul's talking out of a slightly different frame of reference, but he's speaking about the creative energy of God that has gone forth into the universe and, in fact, has created the universe and has called the universe into being, and how all things share the being of Christ through this ongoing and dynamic act of creation. I mean, I hope we remember that creation is not something that happened ago or 13.7 billion years ago. Creation is now. Creation is happening now. We are in the midst of a living and dynamic creative energy of God. And Paul speaks of this as Christ and speaks of it as filling all things and filling all persons. And Paul kind of goes back and forth. Sometimes it seems as if Paul is saying, well, a select group of people are going to be drawn into this new people of God. And sometimes it seems that Paul is talking universally. All creation is eventually going to find its home in the God who gave it being. And nothing will be lost. And so this is kind of one of Paul's more universal sayings. All things are filled with Christ. And the move that he is in the beginning, he's starting to make here, is Gentiles also participate in the life of God and are full participants in this new reality that Jesus has made known. I often think that Israel in many ways misunderstood its vocation, and in thinking of itself as the chosen people, believed that it had an exclusive relationship with God, rather than understanding that God had chosen Israel to make God's self known, and that God was to be revealed to the whole world, and the entire world was to be called into this living fellowship, this living community of God's presence. Not one dominating religion again, but one living spirit of God. And so, Paul was this amazing figure that helped the followers of Jesus turn a corner and realize that they were not simply living within the parochial understandings of Judaism anymore, but they were going out to the world, and the entire world shared and was loved, shared in God's presence and was loved by God. So I want us to keep that in mind, because I think it's actually a fairly important sort of Christian sensibility to begin to see all of creation and all human beings as created by God and thus loved by God. And moving to this, just a couple things to say about the gospel today. Moving to it, Paul gives Gentiles a place in the kingdom. God gives Gentiles a place in the energy and the benevolence of God. In the gospel, we hear a perhaps even more radical step, not just Gentiles, but women. Women offered a place, which is astonishing. Let me describe how it sort of happened. In this little, very brief gospel passage, Mary is sitting in what would have completely been recognized to the contemporaries of Jesus. Would have been recognized as the posture of a disciple, sitting at Jesus' feet, listening to his teaching. She was a disciple. And she was a disciple as a woman, which was radical for that time. And it was a break with a contemporary sensibility. And as with many things that Jesus brought forth into the world, the awareness began to fade. And so how long did it take the church to move away from that radical awareness of Jesus, inviting women into his most intimate fellowship and to become disciples? How long did it take for the church to revert to more conventional understandings of social dynamics, where men had a place and women had a place, and the women were relegated to silence and to be as inconspicuous as possible? That's not how Jesus saw it. And it's really important to understand that that's not how Jesus saw it. And we'll hear in a moment another thing about how Jesus saw things and how not everything is in keeping with how Jesus saw things. The other thing about Martha and Mary is, of course, there's something about the story that makes us side with Martha, because we've all been in situations where we're doing the work and somebody else is, even worse if they're being pious about it, sort of not doing much. And it's grating, but we're reading that into the story. What we hear Jesus say is, Martha, you're worried, you're distracted, you're not present, you're not paying attention. And I mean, how many of us have lived a day where at some point we realize we're running around like a chicken with our head cut off? We don't know why we're doing what we're doing. We're just sort of bouncing from thing to thing to thing. Or, somewhat more dauntingly, how many of us have discovered that we have lived decades of our life that way? A little more difficult admission to make. But Jesus is being kind of Zen master here. He's saying, you know, allow your mind to be focused and be in the present. And you are worried about so much stuff. So despite Martha's perspective, I'm having to do all the work by myself, I would again suggest that we listen to what Jesus is saying. You're worried and distracted. And you can't do good work out of that place. You can't do good work out of that place. And just parenthetically, the Jewish and Christian tradition has always been sort of made up of what could be called the contemplative and the active side. There is the working week, and then there is Sabbath. There is the week in which our intentions get to be realized, and we are God's creative creatures, and we get to do things in the world. But then there is that other side, the Sabbath side, the Sabbath mentality that says, don't act on the world. Don't try to change anything in this space. Let the world be. Just let the world be. And the rhythm of Christian life moves back and forth between those two perspectives. But if you never sort of take that Sabbath moment, however long it be, you never take that Sabbath moment, you're going to lose your bearings. Which is to say, if you don't pray, if you don't regularly sort of take yourself into that place of awareness where you are in the presence of God, and that's all you need. Just let the world be that Sabbath place. Well, Mary seemed to be living a little more out of that Sabbath place than Martha was. And so however much we might hear it as unfair, let's listen to Jesus and say, Martha was being worried and distracted, as we all can be, and let's consider what the alternatives might be. Okay, last thing I'm going to talk about. I've got to get my glasses out for this. The psalm. Was anyone troubled by the psalm? I mean, I hope so. I hope so, because we start out okay. We start out, you know, it's fine. It's sort of in keeping with Amos, that wonderful, radical, Jewish recognition of social injustice and naming it and saying, where social injustice exists, God is not being listened to. And that's like at the heart of Jewish spirituality. And it's the psalm starts out there. You tyrant, why do you boast of wickedness against the godly all day long? You plot ruin, your tongue is like a sharpened razor, O worker of deception. You love evil more than good and lying more than speaking the truth. You love all words that hurt, O you deceitful tongue. So far, so good. Oh, that God would do it. demolish you utterly, topple you, and snatch you from your dwelling, and root you out of the land of the living. I hope when we read those words that the words catch in our throats, and that we deeply understand that this is not a Christian prayer. We have to hear that these words coming out of Hebrew sensibility is a response to evil that says, God, will you uproot this one that we perceive as evil and take him out of the land of the living? Get rid of him. And Jesus really taught something different. Jesus said, pray for those who persecute you, love your enemies, take the log out of your own eye. It is a very different perspective. Kill the tyrant, save the tyrant. Oh God, touch his heart. Help him to see that he is persecuting his own brothers and sisters. Oh God, open his eyes that he sees your presence in the world. Oh God, help him cease being a tyrant and make him a benevolent and generous ruler, that he might be a worker of good and serve you. Oh God, please save this brother who is lost. That's the prayer of Jesus. That's the prayer of Jesus. Not uproot him and take him out of the land of the living. And again, we simply cannot forget that Jesus was in a fight to the death with his contemporaries about the nature of God. And his contemporaries said, you're a blasphemer. You are evil. You are leading people astray. You are accepting that which is unacceptable. You're leading people astray. We're going to kill you for it. And Jesus said, actually, no. You're the one that's mistaken. You don't really understand anything about the love of God. You don't understand how God works. You don't understand God. And so our attempts to harmonize seamlessly the Hebrew scriptures and the scriptures of the Christian community, that task is impossible. Because at any number of points, the Hebrew scriptures give strong voice to positions that Jesus completely repudiated. And the Psalm, I think, is one of them. Jesus simply would not pray for someone to be killed. Jesus would pray that the lost be saved, the lost be found. And I would suggest that the persistence of attitudes like this, and these attitudes are everywhere. I mean, you see them in C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, I mean, I love him as a storyteller. Wow, is he flawed, though. And he's flawed in many ways, but one of the ways he's flawed is he reverts to a pre-Christian response to evil. And in the end, you know, in the great battles, evil is destroyed, not redeemed. And I would say, this is what, you know, a couple weeks ago we heard, no one who puts hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. And looking back doesn't mean just looking back at the past. It means looking back at ways of dealing with human issues, human difficulties, human problems that are less fully realized, that are more conventional and cultural. The conventional, cultural way to go about things is like the Psalm. Get rid of the evil ones. Get rid of the evil ones. Kill them. Execute them. Go to war against them. When we indulge in that perspective, we are looking back at something that the human race is so familiar with, and we know it leads only to more and more misery. Jesus calls us not to look back, but to look forward to an infinitely higher ethic that he proposes, an ethic that maybe begins, he didn't exactly say this, but following Paul, maybe begins with that sense that God's love and energy and presence infuses all things, without which nothing would exist. And as such, all things and all beings are worthy of God's love, even when they behave reprehensibly. They are just being more lost and more in need of that beckoning love. That's the higher way. That's the way that leads forward. Let us not look back. Let us not look back at easy, conventional ways of dealing with life's difficulties that we all know, we've all tried, history has tried for thousands of years, and yet there is this other way, this way of Jesus, beckoning us forward, not looking back, but forward, where one by one, all of God's lost children are loved back home.